Hello and welcome to episode 20 of series 5 of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. This is the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with all that is new in our profession. My name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. Welcome again to the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you're a new listener, you will find over 100 episodes available at our website, which is thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. If you go to the website and you click on the podcast tab, you will see all of the podcast episodes going back all the way to 2020, which you can listen to, consume there. And that's where you'll get the best listening experience, regardless of which platform you're listening on now. On the website, we have links on our show notes. We have a full show note for each episode. And we also have links to our guests and any media that they reference in their interviews itself. Also on the website, you'll find links to our products and our services, our visual communication tools, our explainer videos, and our other internal communications products. So that's the best place to visit if you are new to the show or if you want to get the full podcast experience. Anyway, let's move into the topic for this episode's interview. Many organisations, quite rightly, have a focus on diversity and inclusion at the moment, and we've covered this topic a number of times on the show before. One specific angle of diversity inclusion that we've not covered before, though, is around disability. I wanted to explore the impact of disability on employee engagement and employee integration into the workforce, and I wanted to speak to someone who could speak with true authority on this. So we're going to be speaking to someone who's been disabled from a very early age and is very passionate about the opportunities that disabled people should be given, and but also that the potential that disabled people have within the workforce, and this untapped potential is something that they're very, very passionate about. So we're going to be looking at what are some of the barriers to bringing disabled people both into the workforce, but then also into employment as well. And what we as employers can be doing to better understand the needs of disabled people and to really develop a strategy around getting disabled people within into our organizations, fully integrated and able to contribute to our organizations in a very inclusive fashion. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this interview. Really fascinating guest with an amazing backstory that I think you'll find really, really interesting. So here we go. My guest today is David D'Arcangelo. David is a disability policy expert who provides innovative leadership to lead positive change. David is known as one of the USA's most prolific public policy talents. David is a president of Archangel Communications, which is a limited liability company and is a disability-owned business enterprise. Legally blind from a young age, David is a passionate leader and an advocate for people with disabilities and underserved populations. He has built meaningful careers in the public and private sectors. As a presidential nominee, David served as a council member of the National Council on Disability, the NCD. So hello, David, how are you?
Craig, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure and an honor. For our listeners, whereabouts in the world are you positioned at this very moment in time, David?
I'm just outside of Boston, Massachusetts. You might think it was Boston. It's in Melrose, Massachusetts.
Wonderful. I did the Boston Marathon twice, and so I know a little bit of Boston, Massachusetts geography. So, but I only know the route of the marathon, really. That's my only kind of reference point. But yeah, lovely, lovely place, fantastic place, Boston.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is a beautiful city, and I'm just north of Boston. It's about 5-6 miles, something like that. And yeah, I like it here, and just excited to have a good conversation with you.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. I gave the listeners a very, very brief bit of your backstory there, David. If you don't mind, a little bit more about your personal and also your professional journey that you've been on. That'd be great to find out a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, personally, I was born legally blind. I think you might have mentioned that. Mm. And some of my earliest memories are the doctors telling me and my family, teach him Braille, because by the time he reaches 8, he's going to be blind. And, you know, that was a lot to handle when you were a young boy. Mm. And, you know, I got to 8 and it didn't happen. I got to 14. I went in and the doctor said, listen, if it hasn't happened now, it's don't worry about it. Go live your life. Mm. And so all I heard was live your life. And I did. And that changed me significantly. And I really became much more outwardly bound and much more of a outgoing type of person, you know, and really took that live life to the fullest mentality. But then when I was 20, I went skiing, crashed, detached my retina, went completely blind.
Oh, no.
And so the doctor who said that came into the room and said, yeah, about live your life. You know, I meant it, but I didn't mean it that much, right? Oh. So he said, we've got some techniques, though, that have come around, and we're going to try some. And they did several different techniques at the same time, and I was able to have my vision restored. But the way my vision was restored was fundamentally and completely different than the vision I had previously. Like, imagine having good vision in one eye and none in the other. And then all of a sudden it switches. The eye that you couldn't really see out of, now that becomes your good eye. And, you know, that's where I am. So I've had to adapt throughout my whole life. And that's really just put in perseverance to my soul. And just, I really believe that the path to prosperity is paved by perseverance. You got to hang in there. If it was easy, everybody would do it. So that's my mission in life, is to improve the human condition and use the talents and skills that I've been given to benefit others to the best of my ability.
Well, wow. What an amazing story. And tell us a little bit more about how that's manifested itself in your work then, David. So obviously, I guess your work is in disability, but your visual impairment hasn't kind of defined who you are. You've got that philosophy on life about how you lived your life and how we want other people to live their life. Tell us a little bit about your professional journey, David, please.
My dad was in public service and he was an elected official. So I went to my first public meeting when I was 8 years old, work on my first campaign when I was 10. And so it's kind of like in my blood that way. And really, how do you give back, right? You give back, you can help one person at a time, which I've done and do and continue to do. Or you work on policies that impact many people. And the way to do that is through government. And I've served at the local level. I've served at the state level. I've served at the federal level. So I've been appointed by mayors, by governors, by the president. And I've been an elected official, appointed official. I've run organizations, you know, all throughout politics and public affairs and governing and administration. And so I just really try to put that experience to use for our society. My goal is to improve the human condition. And here in America, many of the programs for people with disabilities are outdated and they're old. And when they were first conceived, they were great and well-intentioned. But now, 50 years later, 70 years later, longer, some of these programs have been in place. They just haven't adapted with the changing times, and they're not modern, and they don't reflect technology, and you know, really, they don't serve the people as well as they should be or could be. And so part of what I'm trying to do is modernize and improve and work on these very complicated systems that have been in place for decades or longer, and just bring them up to speed so we can have better outcomes for our people.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe that's a good point then to dive into, you know, the kind of current state of affairs. And obviously, as you mentioned there, you're looking at this from a kind of US perspective. But I guess, I've limited experience of these kind of the regulations and the limitations in Europe and the UK. But I'm guessing to a large extent, there's probably some parallels as well. But so let's focus on what we know. What's the current situation regarding employees with disabilities in the workplace and kind of how, you know, they're maybe not included, or they're not given opportunities, or there's, you know, outright, you know, discrimination in certain cases. Tell us a little bit more about your experience of that, David, and what the current state of play is, please.
So nearly 2/3 of all working age people with disabilities are not in the labor force. Now, that's true in America. It's also true in other parts of the world. In many other countries, it's much more, it's much worse. And in some other places, it is better. You know, so a little bit of a mixed bag there. But it's all still around the same, that there's that many, nearly 2/3 of all working age people with disabilities not in the labor force. So that's not all people with disabilities. That's working age people that we're defining between 16 and 64.
Right.
Okay. And now that's not unemployed, because to be unemployed, at least you are in the labor force. So again, 2/3 of all working age people with disabilities not in the labor force.
Yeah.
We are failing them. We're failing society, and we've got to improve that. So step one is get more people resolved to be in the labor force, more people with disabilities in the labor force, right? That's step one. Now, many of these programs and laws and regulations that have been put in place have not been put in place to address that.
Mm.
They've been put in place to address step two, which is become employed. Well, before you can become employed, you need to be resolved to work. You need to be resolved to be in the labor force. So my thing is, let's now refocus our efforts to one, get people in the labor force, and then two, get them employed. We actually have much better results on the people that are in the labor force on getting them employed.
Yeah.
Although the data point on that is significant too, the people with disabilities are double or triple the rate of unemployment of people without disabilities. So it's very difficult. And why is that? I mean, there's some real structural reasons for that and real societal barriers that have been put in place. You know, much of the environment that has been built has not been built for people with disabilities in mind.
Yeah. Before we dive into that, David, just to make the distinction then. So you've made that distinction there, and I'm kind of, you know, kind of understand what you're saying, and just so the listener understands what that point then. So what we're saying here is that those people who are of that working age who are not even on the radar to be employed, what is it that then tips them from being not in the workforce, as it were, but maybe still unemployed, into that kind of now I am potentially can be employed? Is it a kind of legislative barrier, or is it a kind of a welfare barrier? What is it that kind of distinguishes someone who is of working age and available to work, or unavailable to work and therefore not counted as being in the workforce?
Right. So that's a great question, and I wish I had one answer. I don't think there's one answer. I think it falls into one of three buckets in my years of experience that I've been focused on and that I've written papers about, and you can go to my blog and see me talk about. The first one is start with the person with the disability. So the first one is about the person with the disability and their experience and what are they thinking they can or cannot do or want to do or not do, right? So it's that. But it's also on the employer side. So it's on the employee and the prospective employee, but it's also on the employer and providing access to opportunities for people with disabilities. Mm. And then the third bucket would be these large governmental programs, many of which are a disincentive or a perverse incentive to not be in the labor force. Right. In America, for example, if you look at many of the public benefit programs, which will take care of everything from your housing, your healthcare, your food, your cash benefits that you will get, right? Mm. So all of that, those all have very strict income requirements. So if you start making money, all of a sudden you're not going to get those benefits.
Yeah.
Right.
It's very similar in the UK. Yeah, there's a similar kind of threshold at which it's not worth working because you know you're kind of losing as much as you earn, as it were. And so you know it's kind of human nature. Yeah.
Okay. So there's two different instances there. Mm-hmm. One, people with a work history, and two, people without a work history. All right. So one, people with a work history. If you go on the benefits, right, you've had a work history, so you know what it's like to you know, have to wake up early and get on the bus or, you know, get in your car and travel to work or do whatever it takes to work, right? At the end of the day, you want to love what you do, but work is work, right? It's not golfing. It's not it's not basket weaving. It's not doing something else, right? So you're now placed with the decision, well, wait a minute. If I take the benefits, maybe I won't make as much, but I won't have to do all that other stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe I can get a little side hustle going and make ends meet and I'll be good, right? So that's one scenario. The other scenario is for the person without a work history who they don't know what it's like. And they're saying to themselves, well, wait a minute. Why do I want to go make an entry-level wage flipping burgers at McDonald's or, you know, working wherever at an entry-level types of job when these benefits will pay me more to not do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so those are two real dilemmas that we've got to be able to solve for. Part of the thing that we're going to be modernizing over the next few years here in America with new leadership coming in, because everybody recognizes, by the way, this is not like some liberal or conservative or Democrat or Republican or, you know, some type of partisan issue.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees that we need to do something. The issue becomes, well, how do you do it? And how much is it going to cost? And, you know, who's going to be truly helped and all that?
Yeah. 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 And I think, again, I agree with you. I think it's not a party political thing. I think it's a case of, you know, there's more to work than just earning money. You know, there's the kind of the mental health and welfare and social and all of the kind of things that you get from work that have nothing to do with the salary and that kind of, you know, integration into being valued in society as well, I think is a really important part of this. And I think, you know, it's more than just a kind of cash, you know, money equation, isn't it? There's a lot more at play than this.
Within that, 2/3 of all working age people with disabilities, within that population, there is the idea for the next great widget, for a cure to cancer, for the next great song or invention or something. But we're never going to find it if those people are on the sidelines.
Yeah.
We're failing them as individuals. We're failing society. We're failing the employment community that could be benefiting from that. It's a lose, lose, lose. So yeah. I'm trying to figure out how can we do a win, win, win? And I think we can do it.
Yeah. 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 I mean, again, I don't know whether we want to go into that now, because I want to cover off the second part of what you mentioned. So you mentioned that's the first, you know, kind of major barrier is getting those people to actually, for society, for businesses to recognize them as employable, and for them to make that kind of, you know, kind of switch in their minds from being I'm unemployable to I am employable. And then the challenge becomes actually, you know, integrating them into a workforce and being a valued member of that team or that organization. What are some of the things that organizations need to have in place to kind of fully integrate people with disabilities and to make sure that they can kind of be, you know, kind of bring their full self to work and kind of really contribute and help create that next, you know, that next widget that you kind of described there? And I guess there's a lot of different stages through that employee life cycle that we need to be thinking about as an organization. Yeah.
Yeah. So it starts with having the organization from the top buy in and say, look, we're going to make this a priority. We want to make sure our organization is reflective of our customer base, of our society and all that, right? That's the first thing. When you get that buy-in, then you can devote resources to it and the bandwidth that it needs. Because again, many companies have never even contemplated this. They don't even look at it, because one of two things is true. They either look at it as a liability or they look at it as an unknown. Either of those spurs fear within the company.
Yeah,
so we've got to make it so it's not this big bad thing, right? And I think the way to do that is to first decide on a definition. Which definition of disability are we going to use? Let me give you an example. Here in the US, in United States federal code, in our laws, there's about 67 different ways disability is either defined or mentioned or referenced. We've got to fix that. We've got to harmonize that better so we have a better understanding of, well, which people with disabilities are we talking about? Because here in America, again, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, that definition of disability is put in place to ensure that people with disabilities don't get discriminated against. Well, that definition is much different than the benefit program definition that we were just talking about.
Right. Okay.
And then, by the way, those definitions are different than the one that we use in the census to actually measure how many people with disabilities there are. So all of these definitions are different, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing you've got to do is let's define what we're talking about here. Because if you show me a million people with disabilities, I will show you 1 million separate instances of the human condition.
Yeah.
People don't necessarily fit neatly into rows and columns on some Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You can't forget that. These are people. They're all different, and everybody has their great capabilities, right? You can't have disability without first having ability. So really, again, setting that foundational definition and then focusing on the ability of the person.
Yeah.
Now, for the employer, it becomes about, well, what can we do, or what do we want to do to maximize this person, and what reasonable accommodations can we put in place to make sure we're getting everything out of this employee, right? So that can be challenging, though, because particularly if you don't have people with disabilities in your organization, it's like, where do we start and how do we measure it and everything else? So it starts with definitions. It starts with putting measurements in place and then putting a process in place. And that process includes things like mentoring, right? How many of your present employees are seeking out people with disabilities to mentor them to see if they'd be a fit in your organization? Then what about internships? Then what about interviews? Are we making sure if we're interviewing 50 people that a certain amount of them are people with disabilities and giving them access to opportunities? Then once they get employed, making sure that people with disabilities are upwardly mobile. Yeah, it's two-thirds of all working age people with disabilities are not in the labor force. The percentage of people with disabilities that are in management or higher, management or leadership roles, that data is almost non-existent,
right?
Which means if it was great, we'd know about it. It's not great. It's probably worse than the original condition of two-thirds working age people with disabilities not being in the labor force. So, you know, you got to get people with disabilities into these management and leadership positions.
Yeah.
And then the cycle repeats and it keeps going. And I just really believe that the employers that have figured this out, they are thriving. And the ones that are not.
I guess there's transferable, you know, lessons to be learned, you know, for non-disabled work. And if you get it right for people with disabilities, you know, I mean, mentoring, you know, I know I can count on one hand the amount of organizations that I've worked with over my career that have had proper, you know, whether they call it mentoring or whatever the name they give it, where, you know, people are encouraged to look after each other and take on a responsibility for coaching, whether, you know, disabled or otherwise, people coming into the workforce. So I would imagine it's kind of a rising tide raises all ships. If you get this right for people with disabilities, you're going to raise the standard of engagement, of recruiting, of onboarding, of promoting, of hiring, all of the kind of things that organizations are thriving for. This must have some collateral benefits, I would imagine. And that's why, is that part of what you see there when you see, you know, good organizations that do this well are flying in so many different ways, other than, you know, they're just great at integrating people with disabilities into their workforce?
Yes. As my professional work here at Archangel Communications, one of the things I focus most of my efforts on is disability inclusion. And inclusion consulting. And I would assert that if you can include people with disabilities in your workforce, you're really, all of the other groups that you're wanting to work with, those are all going to take care of themselves. Because the people with disabilities, there is a very real substantial limitation that they are encountering, right? And that's not to diminish the other barriers that other minority groups who get discriminated against. Yes, women and other minority groups, blacks, whatever the case may be, right? They have real stigma that they have to overcome. The people with disabilities, yes, they have the stigma to overcome as well, but then they have that substantial limitation that their disability is presenting as well. So it's like multiple challenges that the employer and the employee need to get into an interactive process and work on. So if you can make sure that people with disabilities are included in your organization, I tend to think you're going to be able to solve for those other groups as well. Yes, the rising tide does lift all ships in that scenario.
One of the things you mentioned there, which is a barrier to organizations, is fear. And as you know, as an able-bodied person who, you know, who kind of completely gets what you're trying to say, I guess one of the things I'm always conscious of when I'm, you know, and I know when we set up this interview, I was really, you know, I knew I was going to send you a kind of text-based script or a text-based set of questions. And I kind of didn't want to be, I know you clearly, there's technology and process. And one of the things I was really conscious of is being clumsy or kind of, you know, kind of being overly patronizing in asking right. you what I need to do, you know, so there is a, you know, a well-intended concern, I guess, how do you help organizations overcome that and actually just be honest and say, look, I don't know, I've never worked with someone who has a disability, tell me what I need to do and help me to kind of, you know, to just help you kind of integrate and lead a kind of, you know, a kind of a working life that doesn't define you by your disability. What are some of the things you help organizations do in that sort of situation?
The first one is to start with what you basically just said, Craig, and that is come to terms that you do or do not have an issue or a problem within your organization yeah. of representation with people with disabilities.
Yeah.
If you don't even have a definition, if you don't even have metrics in place to measure it, guess what? You probably have an issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
You probably yeah. have an issue. So that's the first thing is to figure out like, all right, well, where are we? Is this a priority for us? Because look, there's going to be certain occupations that might not be appropriate for all people with disabilities. Let me give you the example. If somebody is going to build a skyscraper in downtown London, okay, and the cranes show up to the site and there are steel girders being shipped in, right? And you need employees, you need people to build that skyscraper. You need people with hard hats to go up there and put that steel together. Mm. Well, if a person in a power chair rolls up to the job site and says, I want to build that skyscraper, you shouldn't just send them away, right?
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Because they can order the steel. They can work on recruiting welders and they can order the parts to be able to put the skyscraper together and they can work on managing the shifts. They can work on all that stuff. But you know what they can't do? They can't go out onto the end of the beam and weld and rivet the steel girder.
Yeah.
So that job is not appropriate for them.
Yeah.
That's not discrimination. That's because they can't do the essential functions of the job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so that's the thing that employers really have to get their arms around. What aspects of the job can this employee do? And we want to make sure we're putting job descriptions together that are not screening those people out.
Yeah.
Or are there ways that we can carve that job up? Because if there's 10 duties within the job and a person with a disability can do 8 of them or 9 of them, well, the one or two that they can't do, is there a way we can move that to another job or another way? Like, what can we do to accommodate that person to make sure we're getting the talents out of them? Because people with disabilities, those 2/3 of working age people with disabilities, there is real talent in that pool.
Absolutely, yeah.
But we're never going to realize it unless we provide access to opportunity. And that may mean that you might not just have a cookie cutter approach, that you might need to go, wait a minute, okay, hold on. This person can do 80% of it or 70% of it or what it is, or whatever it is. What can we do to accommodate that delta? What can we do to accommodate that difference? And that is essentially what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Problem solving and that, you know, process with the employer, call it the interactive process as the Americans with Disabilities Act calls it.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, you know, organizations that do this well are kind of, you know, really seeing reaping the benefits and, you know, the kind of rising tide raises all ships. Can you give us some examples of you know, because I always think, you know, take an appreciative approach on this and you know, it's very easy and natural, I guess, given the kind of disparity that you mentioned there to focus on the organizations that don't do it well. But it sounds like there are organizations that maybe, you know, not entirely, but in pockets or you know, maybe across the board, are doing this really well. What are some of the things they're doing that you've kind of seen and I guess going beyond the kind of policies and procedures and into the kind of cultural elements?
Yeah. So that's a big question. Let me approach that a couple of different ways. So the first thing, just as a matter of disclosure, I am a disability-owned business enterprise certified by Disability In.
Yeah.
So but I'd like to plug Disability In a little bit here because they have a disability equality index, which ranks employers on some of the metrics that we're talking about. So I'd encourage people to go there and look at that.
Yeah.
Is it perfect? No. But is it one of the leading practices? Yes. And it's, you know, it's a start because remember, In America, for example, the federal government only started keeping data on people with disabilities in employment situations in 2008.
Mm.
So that's 16 years. So like, this is not like we've got like hundreds of years of data, you know, working through this. This is all in the grand context of things, you know, in terms of industry in America and worldwide. This is still relatively new, the prioritization here. And so, but we do have data. We have studies that have been done by Accenture and Disability Inn and other organizations that indicates that people with disabilities, if you give them a chance, can be some of your best employees. They have lower rates of tardyism and absenteeism and higher rates of productivity. And, you know, so they have more of the good things and less of the bad things want. So it sounds like an ideal employee if you're an employer, right? but some best practices are things like, again, I mentioned putting definitions in place, putting metrics in place. And then the very real workability things of like having employee resource groups. So if you're a large organization that employs, I don't know, thousands of people, tens of thousands of employees, right? You're going to have people with disabilities in that organization that are people with disabilities. It's just a rule of numbers that you'll have it, right? Because somewhere between low end, 10 or 12% or high end, maybe even 18 or 20% of all people are people with disabilities, right? Now, many of those are non-apparent disabilities, and they may not meet the traditional archetypal metaphor of a person with a disability. They might not be in a power chair or have a cane or something like that, but they're still a person with a disability, right? So, you know, I think it's making sure that the employee resource groups are just a piece of the puzzle in these large organizations, and that the employees are helping to drive the change that needs to happen so that employers can be represented well of people with disabilities in their organization.
Yeah. Yeah. I maybe it's maybe too early for this, given, you know, the fact that you say there that the data is relatively young, but I guess it's not unforeseeable that an organization could actually derive competitive advantage from you know, kind of having because you've already alluded to, there's a huge talent pool there which is untapped, and you know, most organizations at the minute are wrestling with retention and recruitment and getting the right people and keeping them. And I guess if you do that really well, that could be a source of huge competitive advantage if against an organization that isn't doing that well and is not tapping into, you know, this amazing resource pool. Is it too early to sort of say that there are organizations that are doing that are getting a competitive advantage, or is that data still kind of not out there yet?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit of a hidden secret, to tell you the truth, and it's proprietary. And I think these organizations that have been able to tap into people with disabilities, I don't want to say they want to keep it secret, but they're like, they don't want to give away all of their secret sauce either. Right. Some of that, but I view that as a good thing. I view that as that's now the market working. That's now private industry taking it upon themselves to do. That's a good thing. Mm. What hasn't worked and what has been the model of these large government programs. And guess what we've ended up with? We've ended up with 2/3 of all working age people with disabilities not in the labor force.
Yeah.
So let's give the private sector a chance here. And I do think that it will benefit them in two ways. The principal way being, you are going to be able to leverage all that talent in your organization. Mm. And that's very real to your bottom line and productivity. Mm. Then the other, which is, you know, less attractive to me, but I understand how it is a thing, is this, you know, is kind of showing to your customer base and to society that, look, we value this. This is important to us. And, you know, people with disabilities can come calling and everything else. I think that, you know, that is important too. But to me, that's secondary to the main thing, which is much more real, I guess you'd say, or valid, I guess you'd say,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That is actually getting the talent out of those people with disabilities and giving them the access to the opportunities. Because when you provide the opportunity, people with disabilities have shown time and time again that they can meet or exceed expectations and drive innovation. It, you know, here in Boston, we started talking about Boston.
Mm.
Alexander Graham Bell made that first call to Watson. Watson, come in here, right? Well, why was he tinkering with that? Why was he trying to explore that communication device? Well, principally because he was trying to be able to communicate better with his deaf wife and deaf mother.
Right.
Well, we all know what happened to the telephone. And so people with disabilities in many ways have driven and continue to drive innovation. Have you ever used an escalator, Craig?
Have you ever used
an automatic door opener?
Yeah.
Have you ever read closed captions on a movie or a show?
Mm.
Right? All of those things are helping people with disabilities. And when you can make it, when you can employ these, what we call universal design principles, and you design something for everybody intentionally at first, that's when we're really seeing gains. That's the modernization that we're talking about here. It's not building something and then retroactively going back and being like, oops, sorry, we forgot to build in access for, you know, 12% or 20% of our people. Like, that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to incorporate that into the original design, have the form follow the function.
Love it. I love it. That's fantastic. David, we've kind of, I feel as though we've only scraped the surface and we're kind of getting towards the end of the interview. I want to just kind of give you a few minutes just to say, look, what have we not had a chance to cover and I'm sure that we could probably have another half an hour on this, but are there any kind of big points, big issues, big kind of provocations that we want to put to our listeners just before we do conclude things that we've not had a chance to ask, or I've not asked you through the questions that I've posed to you?
Yeah, people with disabilities may not fit the archetypal metaphor of what you think, right? So many people with non-apparent, and we wouldn't say hidden, let's not say hidden disabilities, because that makes it seem like it's some mystery or nefarious thing. We don't want that. People with non-apparent disabilities. So we're talking about people with mental health challenges, right? We're talking about people with cancer, diabetes, all these other things that you may not see by encountering them or hear by talking to them, right?
Yeah.
So let's recognize that a large amount of people with disabilities fall into that non-apparent category, right? That's the first thing to kind of break it down, these barriers and stereotypes. And then just really giving people access to opportunity. And I'm much less interested in what you can't do. I'm very interested in what you can do.
Yeah.
So it's focusing on positive things. So I had a blog that came out today. If people want to go to Save As Ability, it's on YouTube or my website, anywhere you want to find it. But it talks about three simple ways that you can treat people with disabilities with respect, fairness, and dignity. And it starts with people first language, you know, not talking about the wheel-bound chair person. No, it's the person who might have a mobility challenge.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so it's that, using that people first language, appropriate language, all that stuff. It's more about just being civil and pleasant. It's about being appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And professional. Right. So that's the first thing. And then again, I don't want to tease it too much out, but I would say go to saveasability.com or go to YouTube and look for me, Save As Ability, and check out that episode.
Yeah. What we'll do, David, is I was going to say this towards the, we're getting towards the end now, so probably now is a good time to say it. We're going to put some links into the show notes. So anyone's listening, if they're wondering where to get those, that's thebigpicturepeople.co.uk on the podcast page. And if you go to that and if you're listening to the episode there, then you're already there. But if you're on iTunes, if you head there, we'll have some links down at the bottom. We'll put that link in, David, if you can maybe send that to me after we finish the recording. I was going to put a link into your LinkedIn profile, because people may want to reach out to you directly, and also a link into archangelcommunications.com so people can have a look there. So we'll put that link into that blog that you mentioned. Are there any other links that you want me to put into the show notes?
Thank you for the offer. Let me send you some things, and hopefully that communicates to our audience that we're trying to improve the human condition for all of our people. Yeah, it's about people with disabilities, but really it's about all of our people.
Yeah.
Disability is one of those things that any individual can enter at any time.
Absolutely.
And we know that we're all in various states of ability. When you're born, you might not be a person with a disability, but you don't have all the ability you have that when you're, 20 something years old or whatever. And then if you live long enough towards the end of your life and you become very reliant upon others again, right? So we have this Goldilocks kind of 50 years
that we all think,
but the reality is like 60% of all people with disabilities are over the age of 60, right? So we know that people age into disability. So it's, let's just be kind to each other and focus on positive things.
Yeah.
I appreciate the opportunity, Craig.
No, it's been brilliant. I mean, one of the things I've just been reflecting on just while we've been talking, you know, and again, it's not about political correctness or sort of, you know, kind of wokishness. It's that word disability, you know, for me, it should be different abilities. It almost compartmentalizes, you know, there are things you're not able to do. You know, it's almost like we need to, like your point there, we need to enhance that you can just do different things. Right. I often look at this from, you know, a kind of perspective of intelligence and our very narrow definition of intelligence. You know, me and my brother can be more different. I kind of do what I do. And my brother, he's kind of like into building motorbikes and he's very creative. He's got more creativeness. And I always think we're just intelligent, but we're just at different ends of a spectrum. And I think it's, you know, ability, disability, able, disabled, you know, it's just a different expression of our, who we are as a human being, isn't it? We normally where we can't do some things, we compensate by being able to do other things really, really well. And it's recognizing that, you know, you're still employing the whole person. It's just the balance of what they can do and can't do are just different to what the sort of, you know, the kind of standard definition of what normal is in our society. So if you get
we're all
past
in
that,
various states of ability, and who wants to be normal, by the way? Normal is average.
It's boring,
nobody wants to be average. Let's be exceptional. You can do it.
Fantastic. Well, look, I think that's a fantastic note to sign off, David. Thank you so much. It's been really enlightening. As a kind of, you know, acknowledging my own ignorance in this area, you've really kind of helped me to kind of appreciate, and again, in a non-patronizing way, you know, kind of what some of the challenges are, but also that it is also, as we said, you know, a source of potentially for competitive advantage, which all organizations want, whether it's talent, profit, whatever way you define competitive advantage and improved performance. You know, I think that there is definitely something in all of those areas from what you've given us today. So I really appreciate that, David, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig. I appreciate you. Hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Take care. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Engaging Internal Comms podcast. If you've got any ideas for episodes you'd like us to cover in future, you can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can use the feedback form at engagingic.com. If you're not already subscribed to the show via your podcast platform, please do so. And if you could leave a review for us, that would be absolutely fantastic. We have links to other episodes at engagingic.com. All of our previous episodes are available there. And if you're interested in our visual communication services, our big pictures, our learning maps, our explainer videos, and also our live graphic recording, please get in touch with us again at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk. Thank you.